Hello, my name is Taya Graham, and I'm the host of The Land of the Unsolved. It's been a while since Stephen and I have posted a new series, but don't worry, we're working on something that I'm sure you'll find interesting. It's a case of a young woman who died under terrifying circumstances, but whose death has remained shrouded in mystery. Still, in the meantime, we want to continue to explore not just the stories of people whose deaths remain unsolved, but also the psychology of a city that lives in a constant state of civic uncertainty that comes with the vast numbers of unsolved murders. And that's why today, we're posting an excerpt from one of Stephen's books, which I will read. It's titled This Dream Called Death, and it's a novella Stephen wrote when he was trying to understand a city that was so comfortable with unexplained deaths that it seemed like it had seeped into the character of the community itself, a town that had lapsed into a sort of psychic coma of acceptance and denial. Stephen was struggling with how to write about it, not just through stories and articles in his role as a newspaper reporter, but as a storyteller who wanted to get beneath the statistics and numbers and reveal how this so-called land of the unsolved had accommodated the psychology of violence in ways both unseen and unacknowledged. That's why he started writing the book This Dream Called Death. It's a story about a city engulfed by violence, a place that had been abandoned to decay and rot and, in a sense, had given up on its future. But instead of arrests and aggressive policing, an ambitious new mayor decides the best way to fix the city is to police people's minds. And it's from that premise that this story unfolds. It's a tale about a young bureaucrat working to implement the mayor's vision and what happens when he stumbles upon a scheme to not just corral people's thoughts, but literally use their dreams against them. Of course, this tale is meant to be, in a sense, a metaphor, a way of looking at how law enforcement overreach can have unexpected consequences, and a tale of how a city, both beset by violence and subject to aggressive state power, can retreat into itself and slowly die from within. So I'm going to read an excerpt from the book, and if you want a copy, we will add a link to it in the podcast details. And please feel free to contact us at landoftheunsolved@gmail.com if you have a case you want us to investigate or to share your thoughts about this reading series, which we hope to continue in the future. And as always, I'm your host, Taya Graham. Now, on to the story. I work for the Bureau of Dreams in the city of Belize. I am a reviewer of waivers assigned to District 4, Sector 3. My office has space for only two desks, mine and Herman Reel's. Reel is the intake director, my supervisor. He is tall, lurching, and flatulent, and prone to tuck dull-colored ties beneath the fold of his belt. I sit behind plated metal desk held together by rust. Only one window, a small portal filled with yellow safety glass, allows natural light to enter the room. When the sun fails to show, which is often in Belize, I work under the twittering glare of a fluorescent light bulb that hangs from the ceiling like an incurious glowworm. It was my fifth anniversary working for the Bureau. Reel was slumped over his desk, asleep on top the scraps of an unfinished meal. I, however, continue to pore over the paperwork of errant dreamers. My job is to review, score, and approve or deny the requests for waivers by citizens of Belize who are scheduled to be remanded to the Waking Recidivist Complex. I am by law required to read every waiver filled in my sector. Some are ketchup-stained forms filled out with scrawled handwriting and littered with indiscriminate spelling errors. Others are neatly typed and precisely worded. All, as required by protocol, contain a synopsis of the dream, a recommended course of treatment, and a prognosis. When I am done, if the case merits review, I hand it over to Reel. My son didn't dream about death, pleaded a heavyset elderly black woman. She sat impassive in front of Reel's desk, a long strand of shot gray trailing into her blouse. According to the Bureau enforcement, it was both severe and reoccurring, Reel shot back. Her eyes flitted towards the ceiling. her son faced involuntary commitment to the complex for at least a month. Real was her last hope. "He's cut back on sleep without even being told," she offered. Real pulled out an ink pad, wetted a blotter, and stamped the bottom of her application with his adjutant seal. 4 hours over 60. Report to the complex by tomorrow noon for dream modification, or I'll issue a warrant." "But," she pleaded. "It is what it is," Real answered. Blaise is an old city. The rotten winds sweep embers off the hives of the old industrial sector, blanketing the few skeletal structures downtown that remain erect with a coat of granular soot. Pollutants thick with ozone and haze leave the sky without the illusion of sunlight or a distinct cloud, just a porcelain gray sheen that glows colorless from the light reflected off fragmented stone. Buildings with gutted facades creep into the middle of the road. Sagging row homes shed paint that drains into culverts, flowing through the alleys like water. This is Blaise, a grimy ball of wax. I stare out of the window of the bus, measuring the grainy patterns of the crumbled sidewalk. My left hand drops onto the cold seat just inches from my chest, pushing backwards so my head seems to cascade off the window as the bus bounces over a pothole. I feel weightless. The sidewalk is slick. Citizens with black umbrellas and hunched shoulders lean into the wind and scramble into alcoves. Black water, acrid rain, cuts through the ancient concrete, carving rivulets into stone. A man sitting in front of me leans his head against the window, then turns to face me. "I've seen you before," he said. "Me?" I asked. "Yes." Just as his lips part to form another word, the bus stops. I rise from my seat, walk down the aisle, stepping into the muck of unending rain. As the bus accelerates, I see the man mouthing words through the window. "It is what it is." My apartment building is a 5-minute walk from the bus stop. The elevator strains against the heat. My living room sags, the floor indented, the result of Blaise's endless humidity. The two chairs held together with cardboard and glue sit adjacent to my refrigerator. A black lampshade hangs over my bed. A single couch stands at a perfect right angle to the window, cushions made of stone. A mouse grazes on the remains of a carrot stuck in the seams of a wall. My cat watches. On the bookshelf, there is a picture of a child. I glanced at, as I do every evening. It is a young girl with long, straight brown hair and a perpendicular smile. But tonight I work. A pile of waivers sits on my coffee table. Next to a pile, an advisory. I light a candle, grab the advisory, and read. "To all sectors, from the deputy major. Subject, dream about death. Advisory number 9287. A new dream about death has been reported. The chief of dream research is currently constructing a synopsis for general review." A dream about death, the most dangerous. When a new dream about death is reported to enforcement, we are advised. If a citizen confesses dreaming it, remand is automatic. But this advisory was odd. There was no synopsis, no narrative, only a vague and incomplete warning. I was too tired to worry about it. I said goodnight to the picture of the girl, as I always did, hoping my dreams would be of her. Real called before 7. "Stop by the complex and pick up the advisory on this new dream about death," he barked into the phone. The complex is the largest building in Blaise, the place where all errant dreamers are fixed. Orange turrets flame above the corners of the glass-sided building mottled with brick. Tall arching columns phase into a spindly web of pneumatic tubing winding up and down the walls of stainless steel. The building is as tall as it is wide, a medieval castle striated with cables. Inside, I locate at the central service desk. I'm a recorder of waivers, District 3, Sector 4. The desk sergeant checks my ID. "Yes," he said. "I'm here to pick up a secure synopsis on the new dream about death." "Wait here." I sat down in a plastic chair soldered to an iron bar. The sergeant returned. "It is classified." but I received an advisory to report the dream. How can I do that without the synopsis? Orders of the deputy major himself, he snapped. Later. Did you get the advisory? Real asked while picking over the terrain of a massive bagel with his knife. The synopsis is classified, I said, sifting through the morning pile of waivers. Real flipped the bagel over, covering the edges with cream cheese. It is what it is. After work during the bus ride home, a sleeper appeared in the middle of the street. He was laying face up in the middle of Founders Boulevard. The bus driver slammed on the brakes. Several riders were thrown into the aisle. Exiting the bus, I fumbled through my pockets for identification. The sleeper is a gray-haired black man with wrinkled skin. His sloping nose spreads along his face like a blemish. His deep-set eyes are covered with sweat. The bus driver pokes at his head with his foot. I finally find my ID. I'm from the bureau. Step back. The driver glanced at and then complied. I grasp the man's hand and bend over his body as his eyelids flutter. I think it's about death. The driver turns pale and then sprints back towards the bus. The sleeper's head rolls from left to right like an epileptic doll. His hands are shaking. For a second, he stops breathing. His skin turns light brown. He coughs violently before gasping for air. He's taken by wagon to the complex. Later at home, sitting on my couch, I think of him. Unconscious sleepers were not an uncommon sight in the city. I had personally discovered my fair share of catatonic errants, their twitching bodies and flittering eyelids unsettling. The Bureau has taught us to be professional, and usually I am detached, except for the dreams about death. Death dreams are different, violent, sometimes convulsive, always unnerving, and at the worst, a threat to the order and safety of the people of Belize. My cat sleeps on the windowsill. The city is quiet. I fall into a dreamless sleep, the picture of the girl traced onto the back of my eyelids. In the morning, Real calls. Stop by District Intelligence and pick up the synopsis of that goddamn dream. The Sector Bureau of Dream Intelligence is housed in a decommissioned firehouse. It is a labyrinth of file cabinets, shelves stuffed with aging yellowed tablets, and cream-colored index cards splayed across monochrome tables. I have an inquiry, I told the desk sergeant. ID, he asked, glancing at it for only a second. Yes? The new death dream. I need the synopsis. The sergeant hesitates, unblinking eyes fixated on me. You'll have to see the director. He's in the back. I walk past a dozen rows of barren shelves. A dismounted globe of the earth sits inert beneath a chair. The director's office sits adjacent to an apparently inert boiler. The director is bearded. He wears gold spectacles. Yes, he said without looking up. The new death dream. Any update on the advisory? He closes a file. And you are? Recorder of waivers in this sector. He picked up a pen, opened a drawer, and handed me a piece of paper. At the moment, we have no new information on it, he said. Has it appeared in this sector? As I said, we have no information, he repeated, as he passed the paper across the desk. If you fill out this request for special clearance, I'll send it up the chain of command. The application was blank except for three lines: name, employee ID, and dream number. Give it to the desk sergeant, he said. I don't understand. Deputy Major's orders, he snapped. It's unusual not to give us a secure synopsis. I am the recorder of waivers. The director stared at me without blinking. It is not unusual for the deputy major to give orders, and in this case, he has. The director lowered his head, opening the closed file sitting on his desk. It is what it is, he said. Have you heard about the new dream? I was startled by the sound of a feminine voice. I raised my eyes from the dream blotter. Have you heard about it? A young woman asked. She was pretty. A lean body in a plain black dress vented at the sides. Pallid but smooth skin. Glistening teeth and slender hands. I was sitting on a bench. It was my lunch break. The bench sat in the middle of an abandoned lot overrun by wild grass and the occasional rat hole. Why do you ask me? We're across the street from Bureau headquarters. I thought you would know, she said as she sat down. bad assumption, I answered. I picked up the tablet. Dream blotter, she asked. Yes. I read it every day. I folded the paper and offered it to her. Have my copy. Already read it. A pigeon landed on the sidewalk. Diesel exhaust from a passing bus spread a cloud of smoke. You're interested in dreams? I asked. What else is there to think about in Belize? Lots of things. That's why we have the Bureau. We dream. So you don't have to, she said, finishing the Bureau's motto with a chuckle. Another bus passed. The sun skidded over a hedgerow. Her skirt was short, revealing a single ivory thigh. Do you work for the Bureau? She asked. Yes, I admitted, hoping to extend my view of her leg. I'm the recorder of waivers in this sector. So then you've heard about the new dream? No, I haven't. There was a moment of silence. Her thigh was bone white and skinny. It's a dream about death, I hear, she said in a whisper. I wouldn't know. Please, you know. There are bad dreams every day in Belize, miss, I answered. A dream about death rarely stands out. But this one, she replied, this one's different. The sun caught her hair in spots, reflecting black waves of light that blurred my vision. How so? I asked, curious. I don't know. I just sense it. She stood up, grabbed the tablet, and stuffed it under her arm. Let me know if you hear anything about the dream, she said, as her hair dazzled in the wind. You can find me at the hovel. I'm there every night. After lunch, I counted. 392 waivers reviewed, 390 errant dreamers remanded to the waking recidivist complex. Yesterday, 356 waivers reviewed, 354 errant dreamers remanded. It was a high tally. For as long as I can remember, 100 waivers were an average day's work. I don't understand, I said to Real as he typed furiously. Why so many? Maybe it's the blacks, he answered. Later, Real took his frustration out on an appellant. 3 over 30, he yelled at a young black man with an expansive afro. The rail-thin teen sat slouched in a chair, unmoved. 3 over 30. 3 over 30, Real repeated as he lowered his seal-like guillotine on the waiver. That's bullshit. This is bullshit. I didn't fucking dream, man. You're making this shit up, the applicant said, dropping his head defiantly until it aligned with the top of Real's desk. 3 hours for 30 days, home monitored and certified. Otherwise, I send you to the complex, Real said. But why? Why? Real stammered. Why? Because you had a dream about conveyance, about stealth, about theft. That's why. Because you're thinking negatively, and it's clearly included on your official Bureau record, so I can't just let you walk away. That's why. Raising his head, the young man whispered, why? I was tired, the apartment hot. A stack of waivers still unprocessed sat on the coffee table. Sitting on the couch, I stared out the window. Black as death, the night, not a sound from the street. Unsettling. I was thinking about the odd dream about death of which I knew nothing. Why would it be concealed from me? Was it too extreme? But who really understood the Bureau? Only the deputy major, I imagined. He made that clear from the day he took office. On the day of his inauguration, humidity dripped like sweat from the sky. His supporters gathered in front of City Hall at dawn, touting coolers full of beer. They were a wild bunch, brawlers, thieves, and lawyers, the crusty class of Belize. After a lusty morning of drinking, the deputy major emerged from City Hall. Broad shoulders, a strong jaw, an arching forehead dusted with a wild crop of dark black hair and manicured sideburns. He looked like a cartoon hero. As he strode across the plaza, the crowd erupted. Springing onto a makeshift stage, he stood at the podium, his back straight, shoulders thrown backwards. At his side, a comely wife with several fidgety children. As the crowd cheered, he raised his left hand in a clenched fist. This is no time for celebration, he said, quieting the crowd. In fact, in my first act as mayor, I am declaring a state of emergency. A state of emergency born of the reality that Belez is sick, a dying patient in need of repair. And Belez is dying, he continued, because she is not safe. And if we are not safe, then we are not whole. Therefore, I am not just your mayor, but a man whose most important job is to guard and advance the interest of the honest, hardworking, law-abiding citizen. I am not your mayor, I am your deputy major, he said, as the crowd cheered wildly. A black banner began to unfurl from the stanchions of City Hall, a banner as wide as the building itself. It blanketed windows, the pigeon-infested vestibules, and obscured the silted sandstone and the crumbling seams of limestone statues. It was so large that all of City Hall, the most distinctive-looking building in Belez, became faceless, an ominous black shrine, faceless and muted. As the banner unrolled, it scraped the ground. The deputy major turned away from the podium and began waving his arms. This is our motto, he proclaimed. This is how we will change the fortunes of this great city. Be conscious. The crowd erupted again. Wild cheers filled the empty canyons of downtown. The deputy major waved from the podium triumphant, discarding his jacket and tie and donning a military-style vest replete with epaulettes. The sleeper was stuck in the most uncomfortable position I'd ever seen. His legs parted in a ballerina's pirouette, the other half of his body submerged inside a large, rectangular standing freezer. I stood staring, a loaf of bread in my hand. A small group of shoppers stood frozen in their tracks while a man gingerly touched the sleeper's feet. "Don't touch him," I said. "I'm from the bureau." "I'm the manager," the man replied. The sleeper's legs were splayed, his left foot twisted, unnaturally. We are instructed as employees to never move a sleeper. Sudden motion and inadvertent movement of the head were all considered dangerous. But this man, so oddly positioned, compelled me to act. Forcing myself into the freezer, I pulled out several dozen packages of frozen vegetables pressed against his body. I then placed my left arm around the base of his neck. Prodding his head free, he rolled onto the floor. He was a young man with short, dark, thick hair, an arched forehead, razor stubble, and the stench of aftershave. His eyes fluttered and then opened. "Where am I?" he asked. "At the grocer." He raised a hand to dim the glare of fluorescent lights. "What was the dream?" I asked. I repeated the question. "What was the dream?" He scrambled to his feet. "Dream?" he asked. "It's against the law not to report it. All of it." I could hear the sirens of the bureau sound softly, still distant. Rubbing his brow, the young man nearly whispered, "Dream?" "Yes, what was the dream?" "It's about the worst sort of dream there is," he said, scanning the aisles. "Tell me more." "No," he answered. "I have to leave." As shoppers watched, he jumped to his feet and then calmly walked down the aisle, never looking back. Later, my apartment is so quiet, I can hear the mice curse. I do not watch the dailies or the freak shows. My view box is too old to pick up the new stations. My only company is the picture of the girl. I think about her, why she disappeared, the freckles on her forehead. Her picture is a memory of sorts, but there's something about her I cannot remember. Where is she? Does she still live in Belez? A pile of waivers wrestles with dust, awaiting my review. But I choose not to work. I decided to seek company, the woman I met in the park. In Belez, one of the remnants of our decline are hovels, bars burrowed into basements of aging row homes, accessible only from alleys, gloomy pits, candle-lit dives submerged below street level, subterranean hangouts full of smoke and overproof liquor. The hovel, the first of its kind, was more than 100 years old, buried deep beneath a guttered alley on the east side. The hovel was carved into the ground like a cave. With a door the size of a manhole, the low ceiling and brick walls make hovels unnervingly compact, almost claustrophobic. It was pitch black inside, or nearly so, as I stumbled to a table. I lit a match and a candle, the only lighting available. I ordered a scotch on the rocks served with a warm beer. The hovel was packed. Patrons I could see under the cover of darkness wore black trousers, silk ties, but in most cases dark leather vests, pants and pullover tops embroidered with spikes, virtual tattoos, and dreamland insignias. Looking for Sylvia, I lifted a candle off my table and rotated the flame. In a far corner, I spotted a woman, same build, similar hairstyle. "You found me," she said as I approached. "Yes." "Odd, isn't it?" she said. "What?" 9287. I studied her face, its furrows and laugh lines, but the general darkness of the hovel made it nearly impossible. Who would know, I wondered, the number of a dream? A leaked advisory, doubtful. Paperwork in the wrong hands, even less likely. But the woman sitting in front of me was in possession of a number, the number of a dream. "Who are you?" I asked. "Honestly," she said, pausing for a moment, "I'm a reporter for the Tablet, the Daily Star." "The Tablet, is that a joke?" I asked, searching again for a facial expression, a raised eyebrow. "No, it's not." She touched my hand. "I've been hearing about this dream from everyone." 9287, I asked. "Yes." "I'm a recorder of waivers, not a press liaison." "I know," she said. "That's why I'm talking to you." "They'll fire me," I said. Sylvia placed a notebook on the table. She handed me a piece of paper. "A gesture of good faith," she said. It was a bureau advisory. "How did you get this?" I asked, incredulous. "I can't tell you." 2, Deputy Major. From Director Passel, Chief of Dream Research. Dream About Death, number 9287. Time, 0700. Dream was reported after an extraction unit from the Bureau of Specialized Enforcement conducted a raid of an alley on the 4800 block of Sojourner Avenue at approximately 0800 hours. During routine surveillance, officers witnessed several white male sleepers in an alley in an area known for negative dreaming. The officers then awoke and questioned said sleepers. The dreamers were separated and questioned. Dreamers gave conflicting stories and were transported to the Waking Recidivist Complex for further examination. After intense questioning and waking remediation, one of the dreamers, a 29-year-old white male, described the dream. "I was riding a bus somewhere in the city. It was a cold, raining day. I noticed two things. Everyone on the bus was asleep, and everyone on the bus was black." "Is that it? Do you have more?" I asked. Sylvia shook her head. "No more. I was hoping you could fill in the blanks." "They won't release the 9287 synopsis." "Is that unusual?" she asked. "Yes." The synopsis was gently withdrawn from my hand. "It's an odd dream," I said. Picking up a pen, Sylvia started to take notes. "Are you quoting me?" Lifting the pen from the paper, Sylvia jabbed the ballpoint at my face. "You help me, I help you. No quotes, all background. Agreed?" "I'm not sure." "So it's unusual." "Interracial dreams are highly unusual, in fact." I paused. "Yes. Whites rarely dream at all, at least not negatively. Most of the dreamers you supervise are black. In my sector, yes." She wrote furiously now, skipping lines with an erratic cursive, bold strokes nearly illegible. "And whites rarely dream negatively," she asked, "particularly when it comes to death." "How rare is it?" she asked, looking up from her notebook. For a moment, I thought I was staring at the face of a child. Only the gentle curve of her eyebrows, thick and dark, suggested a grown woman. "Almost never," I said. She smiled, extending her hand across the table. I could feel her fingertips slide between the crevices of my own. The din of the bar turned mute, the desolate smoke thick as a storm cloud. The sensation of her hand kept me quiet. We sat peacefully in silence for as long as I could stand it. The next morning, there was not an empty seat on the bus. I stood in aisle bunched up like a grape. A hangover turned into full-body nausea. the ride to work was miserable. As the city uncoiled its shallow sidewalks and tattered billboards, the hollowed skyline appeared weary, old and broken, lost and mangled. Belize looked like a town accustomed to decay. The deputy major had promised to fix Belize by fixing our dreams. He said so in a speech a month after he was elected. All city employees were summoned to Founders Hall, a giant public mausoleum that housed portraits and artifacts of Belize's history. Massive paintings of the harbor splayed neatly on a tide of green grass. Giant hulking cannons firing streaks across the sky into enemy frigates engulfed in flames. Striding across the stage, the deputy major wore his military uniform, replete with exotic medals and gold epaulettes. Since declaring himself deputy major, it was his standard public dress. As he reached the podium, wild applause broke out, reverberating through the cavernous room. Before uttering a word, he scanned the audience, his eyes reduced to furtive slits. Then he spoke. "We are a city under siege," he said. "We are a city under attack, without safety, a city without a future," he said. "To turn the tide, to reverse the decline of the great city of Belize, we must begin to believe again." The deputy major bowed his head. "There are some among us, however, who think dark thoughts, those that wish failure upon this great city." Pointing his finger toward the ceiling, the deputy major's face turned pale. He pounded the podium. "We will not allow these naysayers, the negatives, and the critics to avail us of victory. We will not allow those to roam free whose only mission is to stop the citizens of this great city from rising again. We will not allow the corrupt, the malevolent, the partisan of evil still infecting the body of this once proud city to remain. Today, I declare war on those who do not believe, and I am offering you, the workers that have kept this city alive, the chance to join me on the front lines, the opportunity to fight the battle with me. I ask you to come with me on this crusade to save the greatest city on earth." The hall was silent. A henchman of the deputy major standing at the side of the stage began to applaud. The audience joined in. As we clapped, hundreds of steel-blue spiral-bound manuals were passed down the aisle, hand to hand, to every worker assembled in the hall. On it, written in bold white letters, "The Belize Bureau of Dreams. We dream so you don't have to." Thank you for joining me for this special episode of The Land of the Unsolved. Remember, we will be back with a new series soon. And in the meantime, if there's a case you want us to investigate, please email us at landoftheunsolved@gmail.com. And of course, if you want to hear more about Stephen's book, This Dream Called Death, you can click on the link in the podcast notes. My name is Teo Graham, and thank you so much for joining me for this episode of The Land of the Unsolved.